Welcome to Digital Stratosphere, the podcast that helps organizations throughout the world with their digital transformation journeys. Here, you will find independent and technology agnostic advice with no software vendor sales spin to help you make the best decisions for your organization. Whether you are in the process of selecting technology, in the midst of your transformation, or trying to get your initiative back on track, Digital Stratosphere provides expertise and best practices to help. And now, we turn it over to your host, Sarah Dokowitz.
Hello and welcome to Digital Stratosphere, the podcast that provides independent and technology agnostic advice to help organizations through their digital transformation journeys. Regardless of where you are in your digital transformation, whether you're just starting out or in the midst of your journey, this show covers everything you need to know to make your digital transformation successful. My name is Sarah Dokowitz and I'm your host, and thank you so much for joining us today. In today's episode, we are going to cover the ever-changing landscape of digitization and the frontier technologies at the forefront of the future. Today, the concept of artificial intelligence, blockchain, and robotics is still fairly new to organizations and society as a whole. What are these technologies and how are they here to stay? Joining me for today's discussion is Stuart Rubb, the Vice President of Third Stage Consulting Group Europe. Third Stage is an independent and technology agnostic digital transformation consulting firm. And Stuart has worked with some of the world's leading organizations in their transformation journeys, guiding them in their adoption of new technologies. Hey, Stuart, welcome back to the show.
Hi, good to see you again, Sarah.
Absolutely. Now, I'm really excited to discuss this topic with you today because technology is evolving so quickly, and over just the last 10 years or so, legacy ERP and other business technologies have grown and evolved their functionalities while migrating to the cloud. And cloud-based technologies have become the new norm, and we are now seeing different types of emerging technologies speed to the forefront of society in a new way. So what are some of the frontier technologies that you are keeping an eye on as we progress into the future?
Well, I think that you can probably kind of split them into two categories. On the hardware side, we're seeing the re-emergence of wafer scale engine technology, which was a technology first proposed in about 1980. What we're seeing with that is new companies coming along and producing chips that are the size of iPads. And now they've got trillions of transistors on one chip, which is, you know, way beyond what we get in our iPhones today. And I also have been reading about some organizations are now trying to create three-dimensional chips so that rather than just everything being on one wafer scale, the chip interacts vertically as well as horizontally to include processing time. So I think, you know, we've got a few steps left or a few tricks still up our sleeve in terms of the hardware technology. The other one that always probably makes a bit more news is quantum computing. I think quantum computing is probably there or not there, a bit like Schrodinger's cat, if you understand that joke. On the technology side, things continue to accelerate. And that's manifesting itself in the software technology that's starting to underpin that. And we are seeing now more use cases across a number of technologies. Artificial intelligence obviously is one. The exploitation of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, blockchain and cryptocurrency such as Bitcoin is another. And then, you know, everybody's making a big noise about robotic process or automation or screen scraping, as I call it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to maybe like dive in a little bit deeper on these ones. So you mentioned blockchain. I'd love to start with that one. And it sounds like blockchain is the basis of cryptocurrency, which is quickly becoming more and more popular around the world. So what is blockchain and how does that work?
I, funnily enough, when I gave this first presentation about a year ago, I had quite a lot of trouble explaining blockchain, because I actually think there was no scientist in the world that really understood what it was. But I actually came across someone late last year who was actually able to explain it in pearls of one syllable and make it really easy, which was a godsend. So I'm going to try and just repeat what he said. And basically, a blockchain is a list of records that a sequential list of records that have had the timestamp of the previous block and the transaction data encoded by a cryptographic hash. And so once that block is in that chain, that cryptographic hash is repeated in the next block. So that if you try and the next and the next and the next, so if you took this block and you tried to edit it in any way, then the cryptographic hash that applied to this block will change, which will therefore have changed every other block. So you know that this block has been tampered with and therefore is invalid. So the reason that's good is you've got a way of encoding data that you can always prove is the valid truth just by looking at subsequent blocks in the chain, and you can see whether it's tampered with. So in theory, it's a way of securing data that is unamendable. It's like having an image on a write once, read only CD-ROM. Once the record is written to the CD-ROM, you can't change it. Well, this is the same technology, but on a transactional basis. And it's becoming ubiquitous. I mean, now we've not only got blockchain and, you know, even comedy chains now, there's a few floating about that just seem to be based on cartoon characters, which strikes me as getting towards the left-hand side of bizarre. But even, you know, typical Elon Musk's girlfriend, Mrs. Grimes or Miss Grimes, I don't know what we should call her, she's been using non-fungible tokens. Mm-hmm. Now, who on earth ever thought non-fungible tokens was a good idea to call something? But that's a way of digitally certifying digital art as being true and original. It uses the same blockchain technology. And so once you have got a certificate that art is blockchain encoded, then you can never have a different piece of art that replaces it or replicate it, because the blockchain certificate would be different. So that's kind of what it is. It's mostly used in, I mean, the obvious base for this is in payments, mm-hmm. Because that's where this technology most naturally sits. So you find blockchain getting, you know, bankers and investment organisations getting quite excited about blockchain. Truthfully, it's not a thing that excites me too much, so I don't lose any sleep over it. I think one of the interesting things about blockchain is that Bitcoin is that it comes into fashion and then goes out of fashion again. I mean, Elon Musk said that they will accept this Bitcoin for Teslas. And that lasted about 2 weeks, in which case the value of a Bitcoin went from $55 trillion to $56 trillion. And then 2 weeks later, Elon Musk said, oh, actually, I don't like Bitcoin because it uses up too much energy and it's contributing to climate change. So Bitcoin went from $56 trillion down to about £4.60. And, you know, I don't like it. I mean, it's just go away. So that's Bitcoin.
No, totally. There's, I think, a lot of mixed emotions and a little bit of confusion.
Well,
and
the people have made some goodie out of it, and good luck to them. You know, personally, I like to keep my bank notes under my bed, probably because I'm quite old, right?
That's like my dad. He definitely has got his, like, safe stash somewhere, I'm sure. So. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, nothing wrong with that, though. Cash is king, right?
It will become the Armageddon or whatever it is, the revelations.
How does the increasing popularity of cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin affect business around the world? Obviously, we mentioned Elon, but do you think it's in a business's best interest to begin accepting Bitcoin as payment down the line?
I think it's patchy. I think it's a bit gimmicky still. You know, I don't walk in with my iPhone to Sainsbury's and say, oh, please can I pay with 0.00001 bitcoins for my Mars bar? You know, we're not there yet. And I'm skeptical that that will ever happen. I think Bitcoin is the ubiquitous universal currency that may one day come to pass. But I still think it's quite a long way off. I mean, I think there's probably more chance of the euro being a successful currency than there is Bitcoin becoming the world currency. But there's a controversial statement, but we will see, right?
Yeah, no, definitely. Now, I wanted to transition to artificial intelligence. So AI is a concept that I think excites some and also terrifies others. So from what I understand, at its core, artificial intelligence is simply put as pattern recognition. So could you maybe give out your own definition of what artificial intelligence is?
Well, what's interesting, I think, is that the definition of artificial intelligence changes every time you ask anyone. And actually, there was quite a good quote. That said something like, as soon as you say that artificial intelligence can do something, that is not therefore artificial intelligence, because now it's just intelligence. And so, you know, that's kind of, it's a bit of a moving goalpost. The question really is, what is intelligence? Because we had IBM Watson play Jeopardy between two human contestants, and the Watson won. Now, did it win because it was intelligent, or did it win because it had much faster powers of recall and deductive reasoning than a human? And is deductive reasoning intelligence, or is intelligence actually emotional knowledge, critical thinking, and a whole load of other things? And so, you know, you start to get into very dangerous waters. Another good example of this, actually, in about 1974-5, roughly there, I was about 8 or 9 years old. And we went to the Science Museum and we looked at an old-fashioned computer. Okay, I was 9 years old and we're talking about 40 years ago. So these were really, really old computers. But one of them had a teletype and it had a little game on it. And the game was quite a simple game. It was the What Am I game, which actually I still can't find any example of. It must exist somewhere, but I've been looking for a historical one to run on my own teletype over there. I've not managed to find one yet. But basically, the concept of the game is that you would say it will try and guess what animal you're thinking of. So it will say what kind of does your animal have four legs? And you'll say yes. And it will say, I think your animal is a dog. Mm. You'll say no. And it'll say, okay, what animal is it? And you'll say a cat. And then it'll say, well, what is the difference between a dog and a cat? What question could I ask that would differentiate a dog and a cat? And you say something like, I don't know, does it scratch you or something? And then next time you go through the game, it'll ask, what kind of animal are you? And you say, what are you, animal, fish or mineral, whatever. Then you go, have you got four legs? And you go, yes. And it does it scratch you? And you'll say, yes. Therefore, your animal is a cat. Now, is that intelligence? See, I don't think that's intelligence. I think that's just critical thing. It's deductive reasoning built into an algorithm in a computer. I don't think it's intelligent. Mm. But that's all a chatbot is, effectively. A chatbot is exactly that. It builds up a database of intelligence out of keywords. And when you type the keywords in, it gives you the answer. The problem is that 50% of the time the answer is useless. And you still can't get to the human being who can actually solve your problem. Like, great example on UPS's website, I had to pay a customs charge. So I said, went onto the chatbot and said, I need to pay a customs charge. And it gave me all the instructions about how to pay the customs charge. except I didn't have an account. So I had to set up an account. When I set up the account, there was no way to link the account to the charge that I got in my hand. So I said, how do I link the invoice to the account? And he goes, here's help on invoices. Invoice payment is it? And it was, useless. And was there any option to go, please speak to a human? No, of course there wasn't. So the chatbot just failed, useless. And that, unfortunately, that's still a lot of end user people's experience, is that the AI runs out of intelligence, unfortunately, pretty bloody quickly. And then you're left with the dumb computer and the frustrated customer who hangs on the phone for 40 minutes, listening to their stupid music while you actually try to speak to somebody who has some genuine intelligence as opposed to artificial intelligence. So those are the kind of, use cases that you're seeing AI come in a lot. But there are developments in AI. I mean, it's never going to be static. Some examples of that include things like, we already know fuzzy logic in AI, which is, weighting data rather than taking absolutes. So, is it hot or cold outside, is a subjective question, not an absolute question. I mean, you could say it's cold if it's, 30 degrees Fahrenheit or 0 degrees. But in Siberia, that might be hot, because minus 40 is cold, or Antarctica. So fuzzy logic is sorting out data based on weighting rather than absolute yeses or noes. And that's been around for donkey's years. But then you go on to things like artificial neural networks, and you try and put on a reasoning and inference engine in front of that. And a lot of what we're seeing in AI at the moment is our inference engines, or trying to infer data from past patterns. You call it pattern recognition, and that's pretty much what it is. And even in the human facial recognition, that's pattern recognition to a very large extent. And so the way those work is that they work on statistical models, and the more that a model, the more the statistics they gather, the more the model tends to reflect the biases of the data that's going into it. And that produces its own problems, and those problems are things like AI bias. So, a university, this is a known case, a university created a model, and it used students from the university to create the base data for the model and do the initial learning. And most of the students who came forward were young 20X white males, because that happened to be the demographic of the university. I'm not sure if it was MIT or Harvard. It was one of those types of universities. And so the model then automatically had an unconscious bias that if you were old, female, or from a different ethnicity, you were less likely to be successful in that model or to profile correctly than you were if you were a white 20-year-old male. So there are all sorts of unexpected things that, where we go through experiential learning, the way that they're programming the algorithms and the way that they're populating the data is much more constrained and much more subjective, and therefore you get unexpected results. And so the latest, I say the latest technology again, neuromorphic computing actually has been around since the 1980s, but they're now trying to create proper artificial, neuron-based computing. That learns in the same way as a human brain. So it doesn't work on statistical models. It works on a reinforcement of a value and a belief. And so the stronger the link, the more insightful it becomes. I think probably, that's quite a long answer, but where that leaves us is that in our little world of ERP, there is a huge capacity for the technology to make a massive impact. And it has not made even scratched the surface at the moment in terms of impact. We've got a little bit in terms of accounts receivable, AI, you know, that helps us find bad payers and manage those automatically. We've got accounts payable, OCR, invoice recognition. That's been around again since well before the year 2000. So that's not new, but actually now it's probably just about at the point that it's usable and valuable. But really, you know, and I think the other place, the other one that's quite a good use case is in demand planning. So N4 have got a demand planning module that's based on AI. So I've been told it knocks everybody else's out of the park. So, you know, lots and lots and lots of opportunities, not very much in terms of exploitation at the moment.
It's just so interesting, all of these insights about, you know, shedding the light on what we're up against with these new and emerging technologies. So we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to continue discussing the progression of artificial intelligence and dive deeper into the power of robotics. So we'll be right back with more of the Digital Stratosphere podcast.
If you are trying to achieve digital transformation success, turn to Third Stage Consulting Group. Third Stage's independent and technology agnostic consulting team helps clients define their digital strategies, select the right software, and manage their implementations. With offices in the US, Europe, and Australia, our team helps the world's most forward-thinking organizations through their transformation pitfalls and risks. Whether you are embarking on an ERP, HCM, CRM, supply chain management, or any other digital transformation, contact Third Stage Consulting to see how we can help you reach the third stage of transformation success. Learn more about us and download independent reports, videos, and other best practices at thirdstage-consulting.com.
Welcome back to the Digital Stratosphere podcast. I'm Sarah Dokovich speaking with Stuart from Third Stage Consulting. So let's continue exploring these frontier technologies, shall we? So when discussing the power of artificial intelligence, there are certainly incredible benefits to adopting AI into business operations. And yet many people and even organizations are hesitant to accept and adapt or adopt this technology. So I'd love to hear your perspective on this. Like, what are the benefits of AI as it relates to business?
Well, you know, the obvious benefit that all of the finance directors and the CFO likes is that potentially it removes headcount costs from the organization, because in theory you need less people to do the tasks that the AI is able to do for you without any human intervention. Now, that's quite a difficult sweet spot to find, because a lot of organizations, they'll put in something like a chatbot or an accounts payable invoice automation tool, and then they will rapidly diminish the size of their AP or their call center or you know, their HR team or whatever, and then find that there is a residue of inquiries that the chatbox will not be able to cope with, or invoices that can't be recognized and go too far, and then all of a sudden they're, you know, getting backlogs of problems or poor service levels or whatever. And so, you know, the lesson there is, you know, don't try and go too fast. Don't assume the chatbot is just going to learn everything on the first day, and the second day you can get rid of your complete call center, because that's, you know, obviously not sustainable. I think the other thing as well, which drives me nuts, and it's just so dumb, is that they don't give any way, they don't link the chatbot to the ability to speak to a human if the chatbot has not managed to solve your problem. And that is so frustrating, because the chatbots could probably take about 40% of the traffic away from the call center. And there are some studies that say, you know, it varies between sort of 40 to 50%. Some claim 60. Of course, the chatbot vendors claim 80% or 90%, and that's naturally rubbish. But if you get to the point at which you've got to the chatbot and you can't go any further, you then have to get on the bleeding phone and start faffing about with the phone. There's no, you know, I've even typed into a chatbot, can I speak to a human, please? And it does not compute. And it just is nuts, mad, stupid. Anyone who is doing chatbot, if you do that, you should be fired. So you know, there are clear benefits to the organization. Yes, organizations are hesitant. If you're an organization that is getting 50 invoices from suppliers a month, does it make any sense to spend $100,000 putting in an invoice automation tool? No, it doesn't. So they don't. So there's one immediate obvious use case where that's only going to be a value if you've got a very high number of accounts payable invoices that you need to automate. The same is true of accounts receivable. So if you've got if you've got a small number of very high value transactions, then putting a tool in to try to automate those is going to be no benefit at all. They will work where you've got a large number of lower volume or lower value transactions that you can't have a human being eyeballing all the time. So you want to take all of the chaff away and focus on the very big outstandings to be dealt with by the humans. And in fact, we're doing that for a customer at the moment. And that's actually, we're trialing that right now with a product called HiRadius. So yes, people are hesitant about it. In some cases, you get resistance just because people think it's going to do them out of a job. And I first said my personal experiences that they are not good enough yet to really drive significant headcount reduction. They will drive some, but it tends to be on the lower value kind of jobs and roles anyway. You know, not more what I would call complex problem solving roles. It tends to be more inquiry handling roles, and those, whether that's AI or whether it's just a vendor or portal or a customer portal, you know, those are roles that aren't terribly rewarding anyway.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I can totally relate to those bots being super frustrating sometimes. You just want to be able to get to that person if, you know, it's unable to answer your question. So
yeah, I'm mentioning UPS by name because I actually, this happened to me about 4 weeks ago and it was very, very frustrating. And so if you're watching UPS, just fix it now.
Yeah, Facebook's kind of the same. So I'll call them out.
Excellent. There we go. Let's even go down the A to Z of all great American companies and see if they have PR approval or not.
So annoying, especially when it comes to the Facebook ad side of things. That's where I've been having issues. But you also mentioned robotic process automation as one of these frontier technologies catching wind. So what is robotic process automation and how does that work?
It's a lot less exciting than it sounds, actually. Yeah. But it has some interesting use cases, and I'll offer a couple up. In the 1990s, we invented something called screen scraping, which was a pretty horrible word. And basically what it did was that it looked recorded the interactions with a screen full of fields. And then it could repeat that interaction over and over again using different input data, as long as it knew what the data was and the context of it was. So you could use that. Typically, for example, to get your PC to interact with your IBM mainframe, but rather than see horrible green screen characters, you'd see a nice Windows interface with a drop-down list and what have you. And that concept is called screen scraping. So the enhancement to that is called robotic process automation, where based on a set of input data, that data can be input into the form automatically. So if I had QuickBooks, for example, I'm using that illustratively, it will know where all the fields in QuickBooks are. And if I feed the RPA tool the raw data of an invoice in a CSV file, for example, it will populate each of the fields correctly and save it and move on to the next one. And it'll do it infinitely faster than I can. Now, where is that useful? Well, we have a repetitive task of data entry over and over and over and over again. then RPA is an exceptionally useful tool. And in fact, RPA, so there are two parts to invoice automation. There's the OCR scanning and recognition part, which is I've seen an invoice, I understand what that invoice looks like, I understand where the data is, and I've extracted that data. So that's the AI part. And then the RPA part is I'm now going to take that data and I'm going to squirt it in directly to the ERP using the standard ERP form without you having to change the ERP. And in fact, you can go further than that with RPA because you could have two ERPs and you can say, right, if the invoice to address is company X, I'm going to send it to that ERP. And if it's company Y, I'm going to send it to that ERP. And I know, even though those two ERPs might be different, what the form looks like and can enter the data. So that's what RPA is in concept. Now, the most interesting use case, that's definitely a problem looking a bit for a solution, right? Because most people have got a reasonably good automation anyway for their ERP. If they've got a way of squirting the data into an ERP directly through an integration, they already do. So the use cases for this are not nearly as ubiquitous as you might think, despite the cleverness of the technology. What is, though, quite interesting is the fact that a company that I came across actually through a LinkedIn conversation do a tool that is an RPA-based tool that allows you to repetitively build and rebuild your Oracle configuration from scratch. And it does it ludicrously fast. And that allows you to create a base Oracle configuration that will work almost for most organizations with you tailoring it. But as anyone who's ever worked on DBS or Oracle Cloud knows, it's an extraordinarily difficult and manual process to move a configuration from one environment to another. And if you schedule it with Oracle, it takes months. It's a horrible and a shocking process. And this tool can do it in about 2 hours. Those are the little things that are useful to know, because you know those can save a lot of effort and time in an ERP project. And that's a great example of where that technology can really add some value. So like all of these things, I'm sure there'll be loads of people phoning in and writing in the chat, oh, we use it for this, we use it for that. And I'd love to hear that, because as I said, the clients that I'm talking to at the moment, I very, very few are using any form of RPA, despite the fact that it's now been around for about 5 or more years.
Oh, wow. Yeah, super interesting. I wanted to ask, is there also an overlap, or can there be an overlap in robotics process automation?
Well, that's what I said about that's the use case I gave with the OCR, the invoice automation. The AI is taking care of the recognition side of it, which is recognizing the invoice and the text. And then the RPA is actually the part of it that squirts into the ERP. And some of them, again, most of them use a direct integration. So they will squirt it into the ERP using an Oracle connector or a NetSuite connector or a Dynamics connector that will send the data in XML format, in raw format, straight to the ERP. But you can get tools, there are one or two about, that you don't have to worry about the connector. You can squirt it into any ERP. And where that's a good use case is when you've got an ERP that nobody's ever heard of, that is, you know, massively, massively out of date, of which I'm afraid there are still, very many, thousands and thousands, in fact, of ERPs on the market. And, 90% of them are ones you've never heard of before. 90% of the ones you've never heard of before. And half of those are out of support now. And so if you wanted to exploit this kind of new technology, you wanted to do invoice automation, this is a great second alternative to ripping your ERP out and starting again.
Totally. Awesome. Yeah, that definitely clarifies. And do you believe that these technologies that we discussed today will continue to grow in their adoption rate 5, 10, 20 years from now? Or do you think some of these will fizzle out?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. I mean, the answer is probably. You know, if you'd asked people in the 1980s whether PCs were going to become widely used and take over mainframes, they would have gone, no, never in my lifetime. And now, you know, the mainframe is the thing that's stuck in the data center in the corner, and, you know, people forget what that was all about. Now we have new mainframes called Google and Amazon and Azure. So, you know, we've all moved on and technology has moved on. And it's like the telephone, right? We still use a telephone. You know, the telephones that we had in the 1970s and 80s, you know, were big plastic things with green handsets. And now, you know, they're more like Star Trek communicators. So, you know, it's impossible to say what technology is going to look like in 20 years. If I was to make a hypothesis, I think that the artificial intelligence will come a lot closer to what we would naturally believe to be real intelligence, whether or not that intelligence will become self-aware, and then we'll try to pull the plug and it'll send off all the nukes like they did in Terminator, I think is probably less likely. And, you know, are we ever going to see a situation like iRobot, where we've got robots walking up with the DHL parcel saying, here is your parcel. I'm sorry, I dropped it and I broke it for you, like they do for humans. I think that's possible. Likely, maybe, definitely, don't know. You know, who can predict the future? It's a bit of a reach for me to say what I think the next big thing is. I certainly think that, you know, we're not living in an environment that stands still. But, you know, if you believe Elon Musk, which I do religiously, obviously, then we're actually already part of an AI program that's already running, and actually we don't exist, even though I think therefore I am would tend to suggest otherwise.
Totally. I mean, everything's constantly progressing, and only time will be able to tell, I guess. So
yeah,
absolutely. And this whole conversation has been super, super informative. So I wanted to thank you for all of your insights today. Now, if our listeners wanted to learn more, what are some resources that you might suggest for them?
I tell you, actually, I mean, I read a lot of Wikipedia, actually, when I've got a downtime, you know, and I will just see where all the links take me. So, you know, things like we were talking about Turing machines and von Neumann architectures and things like that. Part of that linkage took me to neuromorphic computing and wafer scale engines. Solo paradox was something that I found out about a month or so ago and looked at that. And it really is a very good resource. And it's a lot. There's a huge amount of information that on Wikipedia that I would say, you know, 80% of which is pretty robust and pretty factual. You know, obviously, like, you know, on the internet there are 11 billion things that are not factual and are complete rubbish. But in general, I actually found Wiki to be a good starter resource, and then it'll give you further reading, and that's when you can really get in and you can see what papers have been written and where it's all going.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Stuart. Again, I wanted to thank you for sharing all of your insights with us today.
Great to be here, Sarah. Thanks very much.
And I wanted to thank all of you for listening. Again, my name is Sarah Djokovic, and we'll see you next time on our next episode of the Digital Stratosphere podcast.
Contact Third Stage Consulting to see how we can help you reach the third stage of transformation success. Learn more about us and download independent reports, videos, and other best practices at thirdstage-consulting.com.